In the previous lessons, we looked at damage to property and theft and what proper punishments would be for those things. And now we're transitioning from there to deal with cases of when people are injured because of the actions of others. And today we'll just talk primarily about bodily injury to another. And some of what we'll say here corresponds with what we talked about a little bit in regard to accidents and negligence in regard to property. Well, a lot of those principles also correspond to the making distinctions between accident and negligence in regard to bodily injury as well. So you might hear some same passages. They're kind of interwoven sometimes in the case laws. But I just want to start out and kind of make a distinction there between accidents and negligence. And by looking at one of the case laws in Exodus 21, we've referred to numerous times, verses 28 through 30. The Bible says, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall be acquitted or exempt from punishment. Okay? But if the ox tended to thrust with its horns in times past, and it has been made known to his owner, and he has not kept it confined, so that it has killed a man or woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life whatever is imposed on him. Okay? Couple things to point out here. So first, in the first instance, we have a case. It's clearly an accident. The owner has no knowledge of a problem with the ox, and obviously there's all sorts of hypotheticals and variables that could be included in this scenario. It's one, you know, did the guy jump the fence where the ox was and, you know, had signs, beware of ox? Or, you know, was it a matter of the fence somehow was hit, the ox got out accidentally, whatever. You can imagine all sorts of hypothetical scenarios. In the first instance, there's no evil intent involved. It's an accident. The owner is acquitted, okay? He's exempt from punishment. You're not punished for accidents. The ox is stoned, its flesh is not eaten, and that implies there's a sacrificial thing going on here. What is happening is the death of the ox is cleansing the land. One of the case laws in Exodus 35 says death pollutes the land. You know, we or the blood pollutes the land. We know in the case of Cain and Abel, we're told that. And so, like in ancient Israel, if there's an unsolved murder, if there was a death, somebody comes upon a corpse, sacrifice still had to be performed to cleanse the land. What would happen is they would go out and the people in the city nearest to where the corpse is had a responsibility then to kill a heifer and sprinkle its blood and ashes in the stream, and it would cleanse the land. It seems to be kind of what's going on here with the ox, that it has to be stoned and its flesh not eaten. Okay, you said, why not eat? Well, that's part of the ritual for the cleansing of the land with the sprinkling of the ashes of the red heifer. You can't eat it. You might say, okay, we'll kill the ox, but we're going to make steaks or whatever, you know. No, you don't do that. So there's a symbolic aspect here is pointing forward to Christ and his work of redemption and all that. Okay? But there's an accident. Now, in the second scenario, there's a known problem. You know, this ox has demonstrated it is aggressive, and maybe it gored someone else in the past, but didn't kill him. The owner was aware of that, and he did not make provision to prevent this ox. So if I've got an ox that could be trouble, I might say, I'm putting this one down. Or I'm going to put it in this pen over here that's real sturdy and put some beware of ox signs up and that sort of thing. Lop his horns off. That would even be better. Well, yeah, that would make sense too, wouldn't it? Whatever it is. And he's failed to do that. So he's been negligent. And so if he's negligent, then he's been careless in regard to human life. Now he's punished. Okay? In biblical law, if you have a house, and their houses, they had flat roofs and they entertained on there. We know Bathsheba was on the roof of her house, right? They could actually, within cities like Jerusalem, the houses were side by side, and ordinarily you could walk, you know, across the roof of your house over to your neighbor's house. Matthew 24, Jesus says, when Jerusalem is surrounded with armies, he said, let he who's on the housetop not go down into his house to get anything. Jesus, you know, you get out as fast as you can. And you could basically, you could go from house to house and then go over the wall. Okay? And be, you know, let down from the wall. So, if you had a housetop, you had to put a rail on it to, keep people from falling off. If you had a pit, you dug a pit for some reason, that pit had to be covered. And if you didn't cover that pit, then it's negligence. And so you have these laws that distinguish between what is accident and what is negligence. And, obviously there could be degrees of negligence, and the judges presumably would examine each case. Okay? Is this a matter of gross negligence and carelessness of life? Or is this, well, the guy thought he had it pinned up enough, but really this was kind of, look at this faulty rope or whatever, you know, he should have done something better. And those things apparently would go into the deliberations of the payment that might be made. What we see here in verse 30 is, remember, the law set out the punishment. The victim, which in this case would be the family, could determine up to the ultimate punishment, but could be merciful. Except in the case of murder. Murder, if it's premeditated, it's thoughtful, it's evil intent, then you are put to death. Right? But in some kind of lesser thing, the family can be merciful. And so a person might, in this case, let's say they were negligent, to some degree, and so that was determined that, but it wasn't a premeditated a murder, so the family of the deceased could impose a penalty on him, and he could redeem his life by making a payment for that. Okay? Obviously, you take another person's life, and you're not wealthy, that might mean servitude for you or something like that. But, you know, and it might have to do, you know, is this the breadwinner of the family? You know, the deceased family might have some, you know, say in that amount for situations like that. Okay? Yes, sir.
Just curious about, was this kind of case, does it still require two or three witnesses? Because, I mean, you know, what if it's only the owner that did the rope was faulty or whatever,
Yeah, and those witnesses could be, you know, they could be, you know, pieces of evidence, as we said. So, anything in the law had to be two or three witnesses, or then the person is free. Okay. All right. Well, we also have, yes, sir. Sorry. Well, any other human, but there's prices usually put on the servants and appreciation involved, et cetera. Like I said, so there may be determinations, you know, and this is in the day when, you know, manual labor is the norm, and so prices are sort of according to that, and so, We can assume that, you know, the judges could set valuations based on the economic value. That sounds real crass to us, putting economic value on people, but it's realistic. If you know, like I said, if the person who died, who got gored here, was the breadwinner of the family, then that family is going to be hurt a lot more than if it's the servant or something like that. Okay. Well, in addition to Exodus 21, we have a passage in Numbers 35, which also deals with some of these distinctions, and accidents versus negligence versus premeditated harm. And I'll just read there, Numbers 35, I'll read 22 to 28. And there's some aspects here that obviously are symbolic in nature, that point forward to the work of Christ and so on. But there's still principles we can derive. Verse 22 says, however, if he pushes him suddenly without enmity, this is a heat of the moment kind of thing, or throws anything at him without lying in wait, or uses a stone by which a man could die, throwing it at him without seeing him so that he dies, while he was not his enemy or seeking his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood according to these judgments. The avenger of blood was the nearest of kin who would avenge his relative. So the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall return him to the city of refuge where he had fled, and he shall remain there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer at any time goes outside the limits of the city of refuge where he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the limits of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. Remember what we said about all deaths pollute the land to some degree. And remember 48 Levitical cities spread throughout Israel, and six of those were called cities of refuge. You had three cities of refuge on the west side of the Jordan, and you had three cities of refuge on the east side of the Jordan. So you had one in the north, one in the middle, and one in the south on both sides of the Jordan. So if there's some death, the nearest of kin, basically, this is like the days when, this is the early days of Israel, okay? It's not, they don't have a big nation and a king and judges yet and all that. This is like, you could get a posse together sort of, old west, sort of scenario, deputized people. Well, the nearest of kin, the kinsman redeemer, who is the avenger of blood, who has responsibility for his family member. Now, he might pursue that person. So you want to go to the city of refuge. You want to flee to the nearest one. And like I said, there's one in the north, both sides of the Jordan, one in the middle, both sides of the Jordan, one in the south, both sides of the Jordan. You flee to the city. The avenger of blood comes and, you know, knocks on the gate and said, "This fella killed my brother." And so they hear the case, and then they determine, if this is murder, if this is premeditation involved, then we take the person out and kill him. If it was accidental, if it was in the two men got in a fight or something like that, then it might be a different situation. The person then has to stay in that city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Okay? Now, again, there's a lot of symbolism going on here. This would be the closest thing to a prison system, if there was such a thing in ancient Israel. You live in this Levitical city. You work in that Levitical city. You cannot go outside of it. If you do, then it's kind of like open season on you. You're there till the death of the high priest. The death of the high priest cleanses the land. Well, this is something that's redemptive in nature. We couldn't apply the principle exactly. But what we do see in this, we couldn't apply that necessarily today now that Christ has fulfilled what it's pointing forward to. But what we do see is simply another confirmation of distinctions between accidents and negligence and premeditation. And it corresponds with what we see there in Exodus. What we find in general is that the principles here in regard to injury to another are similar to the ones having to do with injury to property. If something is accidental, then it's you just attempt to make it right. There's no punishment involved. Okay? It's kind of like with the standing grain situation. Fire breaks out on your property and it damages your neighbor's property, then you just try to make that right. Okay? But if there is some sort of negligence involved in the situation, then there's punishment. Okay? If it's accident and nobody can really determine, then the families kind of split the cost. Okay? Exodus 21:35. If one man's ox hurts another so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox they shall also divide. Okay? So your animal kills my animal. It's an accident. We're just going to sell both the live and the dead, and we're going to split it. Okay? There's no accident. There's no evil intent, so there's no punishment. Yes, sir. Yeah, it's not premeditation. So,
Why? Why
is he even there for that purpose?
So, in other words, if you're trying to protect the person. The city of refuge was a place of protection for someone who committed manslaughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is protection for his death, but it is still kind of an imprisonment. So it is a punishment. It would generally impoverish someone to a large degree. And the reason why, remember, all the families got lands. They each got land. The Levites got the cities. And the Levites got their money from the tithes of the people with the lands. So you are cut off from your land. And, you're going to be a renter inside the city, And so there is punishment involved in that case. And maybe you can develop a trade or something and sell some goods inside there, but you are restricted. But it's a diminished punishment.
Okay. Anybody was up to the person to actually go to the city.
Yeah, well, unless he flees to that city of refuge, that avenger of blood, he's an open season on him. That avenger of blood can get him. No.
Okay.
I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't say that. No. He flees. This is kind of protection that the avenger of blood doesn't do something in. I think it's more like dealing with people in the reality of where we might be. So I've killed somebody. I'm going to flee for my protection so this guy doesn't get me. Well, he comes and then he, like I said, he knocks on the door and they try him, and then, now it is determined that this person had been negligent, or in the heat of the moment they got in a fight and he killed him, and it wasn't premeditated. So now he can't come out. If he comes out, then it's not murder. The avenger of blood can execute him. It's like he's broken out of prison, so to speak. I probably misspoke. I think it's more, you know, how the Bible gives us laws for divorce because we live in a sinful world and sometimes that's going to happen, et cetera. I think that is kind of like, you flee there. We're trying to diminish the possibility that this is done. If it comes, if the trial, I had to go back and read up more on, it's been a while since I've read on City Refuge, but if the trial determines that the person is completely innocent of it, there's no evidence, then he leaves the city. Okay? So he has somehow been responsible for it. He's got to stay in the city of refuge, or the avenger of blood can then execute him. He's kind of like the prosecutor of the family. He's also there's a word here, it's called Goel. And the word that's used of the avenger of blood is the same word that's used of the kinsman redeemer. So like Boaz was Naomi's kinsman redeemer. So he's responsible. Well, he wasn't first in line, but he was like the next in line. So you had a responsibility. This is still kind of a clan system at this point. You got a responsibility for your nearest of kin. He doesn't have a child. You raise up a child for him. Or you might have a responsibility to avenge his death in the event someone took his life. Again, if it turns out it's murder and it's premeditated, then, you know, he's gonna be involved in the execution of the person.
But if it's something less, I find that in verse 19 of chapter 35, the avenger of blood himself shall slay the murderer when he meets him. He shall slay him.
Yeah, the community, I should say, the community is always involved in the execution of the person. The witnesses, when Jesus says, he is without sin, let him cast the first stone. He's saying, he who is without fault in this matter, you're a witness, you got to cast the first stone. So if I'm a witness in this trial, I cast the first stone, and then the rest of the community is engaged in it. There's no hired henchman with a hood over his head lopping off people's head. The community has to administer justice. The witnesses, the avenger of blood, then the rest of the people. Usually what you have left there is a pile of stones, and that becomes a marker for other people to see, and all Israel shall hear and fear.
So if it's manslaughter, there's negligence involved, but it wasn't premeditated by murder. Mm-hmm. And so the kinsman redeemer, so to speak, could kill that person if they hadn't yet gone to the city of refuge?
No, I don't think he might be tempted to do that. And that's why there's a city of refuge to flee to quickly, to hear the crime, huh?
Would he not be in violation of the law himself if he killed that person to exact some kind of
That's what I said. I think I misspoke initially. I didn't understand, but yeah, it is in place there because there would be this tendency for someone to do that. No, the person who committed the crime has his day in court. Okay. But the Bible is like realistically dealing with the fact that there would be a temptation to do this. So I've done that. I better go flee to that city of refuge. Okay. Then I get my day in court, and then they decide whether to, okay, you stay in the city of refuge, or we're going to turn you over to this guy to kill you. Okay. And again, there would be a lot dependent on the degree of negligence. There's several scenarios depicted there in Numbers 35. Two guys in a fight. One guy kills the other. I guess it's one thing if, you know, he's just pounding him or whatever. Sometimes people get hit in the chest, you hear sometimes like these stories of people playing baseball and there's something like a baseball hits them in the chest and they die or something like that. There's some kind of weird thing about it has to do with a heartbeat or something. I don't know. So I guess, you know, the judge has got to hear the scenario, what it is and determine the degree of negligence involved. And then make the decision accordingly. Yes, sir.
So then the person who committed manslaughter is kind of like waiting, like, hey, you know, and maybe it's better for me to take my chances out here and risk it with the Avenger, the Kinsman Redeemer, versus go to the city of refuge and have to do, so he's sitting there waiting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that'd be a pretty big chance, you know, and I guess maybe especially you might be determined who you're dealing. Oh, if the guy didn't flee? I don't think if the guy didn't flee, I wouldn't think if he chose not to go there. I'm going to have to go back and read that, but I would think if he doesn't go to that city of refuge for his, then, I mean, he purposely doesn't choose to go. I would think that Avenger of Blood would be off the hook in that case. You know, because he neglected to take advantage of the court system, I would think, in a situation like that. I didn't know I was going to get into cities of refuge stuff so much today. So it's been too long. Yeah.
I think one thing that through all of this and all these laws and everything, Seth knows Brian Friedel, you know, this guy always has a spin on, not a spin, but a different take that you just don't really think about all the time. But then when he says it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That there's always an opportunity for whoever the person wrong to be merciful.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that people really miss when they did the distinction between
Yeah, all this talk about death and all that, it just seemed, you know, it just seemed like harsh and cruel. I will say, we do have to understand that this is Israel in its infancy. God, the way He works on us, He works on people corporately. I think it's significant to point out that there is no death penalty prior to Noah. It's like, God did not give that prerogative to humanity until the time of Noah. It's just too much of a responsibility. You don't give your 10-year-old the car keys. With Noah, God gives as a way to curb evil, because remember, the whole world became evil. So as a way to curb evil, He gives Noah the right of capital punishment for murder. When we come to the Mosaic law now, and we're 1,000 years out, more than that, now the number of capital crimes increased to 18 altogether, but they are not required. It's potentially, but in most of those cases, there wouldn't have been, because there would have been a payment, except for murder. Murder has to be execution of the person. So there is this kind of, you know, this is the early, the tribal Israel. They don't have a centralized government. There is no king. These are laws given to the nation as they're in the wilderness, heading to the promised land, etc. The ones in Numbers envision life in the promised land, in those early confederated group of tribes. So there is like increased there's increased responsibility, and but there's still some of this the way it's administered seems very, very foreign to us and in our ways. It's not a big established government officials. It's kind of, like I said, the West, when somebody did something bad, then they deputize the men, they form a posse, and they go get somebody. Okay? Yes, sir.
We also have kind of a warped idea of what's harsh and cruel.
Right.
Because the guy that obviously killed somebody was on death row forever, filing appeals, maybe even getting parole again, and he's just a family and his victim, and has to get, you know, dragged through the experience again and again every time this guy tries to get off. Get out of prison, or, you know, he starts making paintings.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's cruel to the victim today, oftentimes. Okay. Let me say this real fast. In the case of bodily injury, distinctions are similar to theft. If it's accident, or damage of property, I should also say. If it's accident, then there's simple a payment. It could be, I hurt you and you're out of work for a week. You know, I've got to pay your medical bills and compensate you for the time lost. Okay, and that's one of the case laws in regard to men fighting. If men fight, or let's see, I might miss an verse 18, 19. And men contend with each other, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die, but is confined to his bed. If he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. So, I hurt you. You know, there's kind of responsibility. There is a degree of negligence there, isn't it, in a fight? But oftentimes it can be hard to sort out who did what, who's responsible, etc. Be one thing if it's a mugging and a person's attacking another. Here's a fight. One guy hurts the other guy, so I got to pay your medical bills. And for your time off, okay? If the situation is escalated where there is evil intent involved, then there is not only simply recompense or you know, payment, but there's also punishment involved. It's just like with the difference between I accidentally damage your property, I got to make it right. I intentionally steal for you, I got to make it right, plus punishment, plus that I am punished to the degree of harm I intended to do with you. Okay? So the same principle in regard to property kind of applies in regard to bodily injury. And the principle is eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand. Okay? Let me read this scenario in verse 22, Exodus 21, 22 and following. If men fight and hurt a woman with child, and this is kind of difficult, does one of them like strike the man's wife? Does she get involved in the fight? Did he, you know, did the two guys, are one throws the other guy and then against, you know, and she's a spectator? It's hard to tell. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband imposes on him. And he shall pay as the judges determine. So there's a degree of guilt here. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Notice here, this is a very important passage in the abortion debate. If any harm follows, if that child dies as a result of what happens here, then it's life for life. Advocates of abortion have tried to get around this, and instead of saying a premature birth, they want to argue that's not what the text says. This is dealing with cases of miscarriage, because they want to get away from the fact that the Bible is treating the child in its womb as a human being. So if I strike a pregnant woman and take the life of the baby, then that's my life. Okay? All right. Notice, here's the point I want us to see. When it comes to the punishment is eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. What that means, again, we've talked about this before, is the punishment fits the crime. All right, that's another case in point. We hear Old Testament law, we think it's barbaric, when in reality what it's saying is the punishment should fit the crime. And that, in general, means not only it warns against leniency, but also the extremities of punishment. You take out my tooth, I cut off your hands and your feet and gouge out your eyes, okay? That's also our tendency, okay? So the biblical law guards against that. We'll turn over to your next page, and we can run through this quick because y'all have heard me talk about this before. People are often mistaken in believing that Jesus is against this principle of eye for eye, tooth for tooth, or what is known as the lex talionis, okay, the law of retaliation, as it's called. Because in the Sermon on the Mount, he seems to go against that. In Matthew 5:38 following, he says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also." Okay? You've heard eye for eye, tooth for tooth. That's how we used to do things back when God was this mean, harsh Old Testament God. And now I'm telling you that's no longer in effect. Okay, that's kind of the mentality people often think. Jesus has done away with this law. But we have to remember, before Jesus begins the Sermon on the Mount, or before he gets into his exposition of the law, he knows he's going to say some things that some people are going to easily misconstrue. And so he clarifies what he's going to say in 17 to 20. He says, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law of the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For surely I say to you, heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay? I'm going to say some things that are going to appear to be against the law. But hey, I didn't come to do away with the law. I came to uphold it. And, I'm still for the law. Curiously, Jesus mentions the scribes and Pharisees because I believe what Jesus does in the remainder of the Sermon on the Mount is he's not taking issue with what the Old Testament taught, but rather with what the scribes and Pharisees taught. That's why at the end of the Sermon on the Mount at the end of chapter 7, it says, and so it was when Jesus ended these things that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. They saw a clear contrast between Jesus' teaching and the scribes, who were always appealing to their traditions. Okay? The important thing to note is that throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus introduces each topic by saying, you have heard it said. Okay? He doesn't say Moses said, now I'm telling you this. He doesn't say it is written, but I say unto you. Repeat, he says, you have heard it said of old, but I say unto you. In other words, here's what your teachers have taught you. These are the Pharisaical traditions. And so what he's doing is taking issue with the Pharisaical traditions. So Jesus says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Okay? The Old Testament teaches that. All right, as we've seen. But what the Old Testament teaches is, I hurt you. We go to the judge. The judge determines guilt or innocence. And then I determine the punishment up to that set amount. I can't go tenfold. I can't go overboard. You took out my tooth. I want both your eyes and your ears, and, you know. And so that's what the law said, okay? And ordinarily, given what we said about paying a price, that means I could always take some monetary payment in the place of the physical damage done to you. After all, what good would it do for me to take out your tooth if I've lost a tooth? Ordinarily, what would happen is you would pay my dental bills and maybe whatever time off from work that I had going to the dentist. That's what it'd be. Now, I couldn't ask you for $4 million for that, okay, because of the principle eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It's got to be proportional. Ordinarily, that's what would have happened. It's not barbaric at all. It makes perfect sense. It's important we see that eye for eye, tooth for tooth has great logic to it because of the tendency not only to be too lenient, but to be too extreme. We see this in Genesis 4. Lamech warns, if anybody hurts him, he will be avenged, 77-fold. I'll just read, if Cain shall be avenged 7-fold, then Lamech 77-fold. Okay? You hurt me, then, boy, I'm really gonna hurt you. Okay? You do this to me, I'm coming back with a vengeance 7-fold, whatever. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth says, no, the punishment has to fit the crime. And as I mentioned before, well, this was the fundamental principle in theft. It's the fundamental principle in regard to bodily injury. We see this is the way God deals with people. Obadiah 15, as you have done, so it shall be done to you. If you learn that rule, it makes a whole lot of sense of lots of biblical punishments. Okay? When you come to the New Testament and the Bible says, Jesus says, whoever is ashamed of the Son of Man in this generation, well, I'm going to be ashamed of him on the day of judgment. Okay? Paul says, he's talking about how our bodies are a temple of the Spirit. Whoever destroys their temple or destroys the temple, then he will be destroyed. Okay? The punishment is always proportionate to the crime. And Jesus isn't doing away with that. What he's doing away with is, what he's arguing against, is the Pharisaical perversion, which started taking justice into its own hands. You knock out my tooth, I'm going to knock out your tooth. Well, that's not how it worked. You know, that's what they did. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. You did this to me, I'm doing it to you. And what that was doing was escalating violence, particularly with the Romans. We have to remember Jesus is making these comments to Jewish people who are under Roman occupation. And the Jews are at it with the Romans. And Jesus could see what was coming. The Romans were only going to put up with so much. Eventually they were going to crack down on the Jews. And of course that's exactly what they did in AD 66 to 70. And so what Jesus what he's arguing against is this revolutionary tendency. These Romans do it to us, we're going to do it to them. Let me read at the bottom of that second page. In light of the above, what Jesus is speaking against is not the biblical principle that a punishment should fit the crime, but rather the first century Jewish tendency to engage in revolutionary violence against those who held them in occupation. In short, just as Jeremiah had warned Judah centuries before to submit to the Babylonian yoke, so also in the same way Jesus was warning his contemporaries not to join the zealots in their inevitable conflict with Rome. Okay? Don't escalate problems, okay, unnecessarily. If you look on the last page, it's also important to point out, Jesus says, whoever smites you on the right cheek, okay, this is a backhanded slap. Jesus is not a pacifist. I don't know where, I've had several students come back, going off to Christian colleges and stuff, and they're enamored with pacifism. And they'll cite this, and it drives me crazy. Pacifism is evil. If I see my neighbor being beaten up or something, I can't do anything about it because I'm a pacifist. No, I have a responsibility to try to protect you and to protect my own life from evil men. This is not pacifism. Whoever smites you on the right cheek, this is an insult. This is a backhanded slap. Okay? And turn to him the other also. Okay? Don't respond in kind. Don't respond eye for eye, tooth for tooth. You slap me, I'm slapping you back. Because what happens there? You know, you push me, I push you back harder. You're going to push me back harder. And then the next thing, you know, push comes to shove, which then comes to fisticuffs. You're better off walking away. Remember the case law? You get in a fight. Even if you win the fight, you hurt the guy, you might have to be paying his medical bills. You're better off, you know, so much for our ideas of honor and stuff. But if you can de-escalate a situation, always better off de-escalating it. Okay? If you find yourself in a situation, you got to fight. Well, then, you know, to defend yourself, the Bible allows self-defense and even to the point of deadly force if your life is threatened. Okay, that's one of the case laws we might look at later. So again, Jesus is not describing somebody coming at you with a knife, okay, and you go out, you're just going to stand there. Now this is stupid. Okay, this is an insult, and he's like, don't escalate it. Okay, don't escalate it. You can suffer a backhanded slap, whatever. And that's why when Jesus goes on to say, someone wants to sue you, take away your tunic, give him a cloak also, you're better off not going with that. Somebody compels you to go a mile, go with him too, etc. Last note, given the situation where Jesus instructs us for Israel to not respond in kind, instead of returning evil for evil, Jesus calls on his disciples to break the cycle of violence before it escalates further, as would be the case if the people were intent on applying the law of retribution as a matter of personal vengeance. Historically, when such is the case, the cycle of violence of eye for eye for eye for eye goes on forever until no one has any eyes left. Okay? Think of Hamlet. Okay? Before it's all over, everybody's dead. Okay? That's the thing Jesus wants to avoid. He's not getting rid of the principle of eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The punishment should fit the crime. He himself enacts the same thing in his punishments. And when you see God bringing judgment on nations oftentimes and people in Scripture, just keep that in mind. A lot of times you look at the offense, you look at the punishment, and you see that's how he always administers punishments.